On this episode of This Week in Space, we're talking to Rachel Lyons, Executive Director of Space for Humanity, about us regular folks going to space. Stay with us.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is This Week in Space, episode number 65, recorded on June 9th, 2023. Space for everyone.
Listeners of this program get an ad-free version if they're members of Club TWiT. $7 a month gives you ad-free versions of all of our shows, plus membership in the Club TWiT Discord, a great clubhouse for TWiT listeners. And finally, the TWiT Plus feed, with shows like Stacey's Book Club, The Untitled Linux Show, The Giz Fizz, and more. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit, and thanks for your support.
Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Space, the Send Me to Space edition. I'm Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine. I'm here with the ineluctable Tarek Malik, editor-in-chief of space.com. Good day, sir.
Good morning. Well, good afternoon. Well, whatever time of day it is. Hello, Rod. Nice to see you. So
I'm here with the confused Tarek Malik. How are you today? No, I'm sorry. I'll go ahead. And today we are joined by the delightful Rachel Lyons, the Executive Director of Space for Humanity. Hello, Rachel. Thanks for coming on.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure having you. But I'm about to end that pleasure because I'm going to tell a space dad joke.
Oh, I'm ready. Okay. My favorite part of the week.
This comes from our space joke guru listener, Matthew McCormick. Hey, Tarek.
Yes, Rod.
Do you know why Pluto did not attend this year's International Space Development Conference?
No. Pray tell. Pray tell. Why?
Because it forgot the planet.
I love it. Well, technically, Pluto's not a planet, right? And so, oh, no.
Oh, I know some people are going to be very upset at you.
I'm just going by international definitions. That's all. So
I used to work with Mike Brown at Caltech a little bit when he was really pushing his Pluto killer domain name, and he did not get a lot of love for that. All right. So don't forget to do us a solid, please. Make sure to like, subscribe, and all that stuff. And don't forget to send us your space jokes, because we use them and we give you credit and absolutely nothing else, because we love you. All right. Let's get on to some headlines before we get into the good stuff. I'd like to call this first one. You ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
Bad Boeing. From Ars Technica, Boeing, besides their other problems, of which there are more than a couple, Boeing is now being sued for theft of intellectual property with regard to the SLS moon rocket. What's going on?
Yeah, this came from Ars Technica, but also from others. CNBC, I saw Michael Sheets had a really good piece about it too. But there's a Colorado a company called Wilson Aerospace that has slapped Boeing with an IP theft lawsuit. And it's really, really strange. They're basically saying that Boeing hired this company, Wilson Aerospace, small parts and tooling company, to design tools that they need to work on the SLS rocket, as well as other contracts for aircraft, et cetera, for Boeing over the years. And that, among other things, because there's 10 different claims that this company alleges, they're saying that Boeing, you know, got their designs for these tools to work on SLS, and then promptly said, you know, thank you, there's the door, and then built their own versions of them. And it gets weirder. They're saying that because Boeing made different versions of these tools, that might have led to the leaks that could have endangered astronauts, you know, and everything on the pad. It's a very strange a set of allegations. Boeing, for their part, says that the lawsuit is full of errors and it's unfounded, and they're going to fight it tooth and nail in court. And there are inconsistencies in it, but it's something that's very strange at a time that isn't that great for Boeing. We were talking just recently about Boeing's problems with Starliner and the fact that they're delayed indefinitely for that mission too. This is not an issue that they would really want to be dealing with, coming on the heels of what is arguably a pretty good first test flight of that SLS rocket. Now they have to deal with this this potential lawsuit too. So it's something to watch over time, and it's just another kind of hit that they're going to have to deal with over the next few weeks and months.
Big sigh. All right, next up from Space News, We have one that I like to call, "Hey, Elon, sell Twitter already." NASA's concerned over delays on Starship, which just a few weeks ago they were saying, "Nope, we're good. Everything's fine." What are they saying now?
That's right. Well, this might be from the desk of no surprise, but basically the Space Studies Board had a meeting, the National Academy's Aeronautics and Space Engineering Board. They have a meeting every year or so. And during that meeting, Jim Free, NASA's Associate Administrator for Exploration, that means he's like their exploration systems chief, gave a big rundown, not just of Artemis 3, which is the moon landing mission that will use SpaceX's Starship lander to put astronauts on the moon for the first time since the 70s, but also on, you know, the success of Artemis 1, the progress of Artemis 2, that first crewed flight, which is supposed to launch next year. And he said very clearly that he is concerned about the ability to reach the moon by 2025, which is already a delayed target right now for NASA and Artemis because of the long lead time needed to prove out SpaceX's Starship lander. SpaceX has our listeners might recall, won the contract to land the Artemis 3 astronauts on the moon. They did do their first test launch, which, of course, did explode on the way up. But SpaceX says that they learned a lot from it. They did destroy their launch pad, and they are trying to rebuild it right now. But, you know, getting to orbit is one thing for Starship. And what Jim Free is worried about is they have to get to orbit many, many times. They have to show that the rocket can reach orbit. They have to show that it can change its trajectory in orbit for a moon trip. They have to show that they can dock two of these starships in orbit together to transfer cryogenic fuel between them, because that's how they're going to get to the moon. They have to do this refueling in space, and then they have to, of course, get the human occupancy side of it, the life support systems, all of that safety into it. Those are all in the future. And Elon Musk has said many times, oh yeah, we can solve those really easy. We just have to do all of these things. But Jim Free says that's a lot of launches, a lot of launches for Starship that they have to do over time. And he's concerned about the time crunch between now and December 2025 to get there. He said very clearly they're expecting a likely slip to 2026 at least. And of course, that has a rubber band effect for everything else that comes after it. Their plans for Gateway, their plans for a moon base, etc. So that's kind of where we are. They're concerned. They're still hopeful that SpaceX is going to be able to ramp things up. We haven't heard a lot of progress on the repairs to the pad side, aside from the fact that they're testing a new base plate that is water cooled after they destroyed it with the April 20th test flight. But we're going to kind of see how this pans out, because we are about the 2 month. We're coming up on the 2 month mark from that test flight. And that was when Elon Musk said they'd be ready to fly again.
All right. And finally, we have from Live Science, your partner channel, SOS from Space.
That's right. That's right. So scientists have come up with what they think is a new technique for listening for aliens. And they think that this might be a game changer. Some scientists over at Cornell University have come up with it's like a software that can listen for radio pulses from the core of our galaxy. And of course, the most tried and true are pulsars, because they pulse regularly. So they're good target stars to test this. And the folks at Breakthrough Listen, which is a separate campaign in partnership with SETI, et cetera, that are listening for these signals, are paying attention. And so they're excited that they can use this new software to look deeper and a little bit more with a fine tooth comb at all of the radio noise coming out of the center of our galaxy. So this, you know, it's very new. These are frequency ranges that are really small. Like they're about a tenth the width of what we listen to on the FM radio. And so they've got this sensitive software that can start sifting through it. And then if those signals are there from ET, hopefully we can tune in and say, hey, what's going on? And then I guess they'll hear us in like a few million years because of the distance involved.
Always optimistic. All right. We will take a short break for a message from our sponsor and be right back with Rachel Lyons. Stay with us. And we're back. So, Rachel, I've known you for a number of years, and I was so thrilled when I saw that you had been given the executive directorship of Space for Humanity. And that was actually when I learned about Space for Humanity and before I really knew Dylan Taylor, who we've had on the show and our listeners know well. Can you tell us a little bit about what Space for Humanity is and what you do, and then about your journey into that slot?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, Rod, it's great to see you and great to talk to you again. I think it's really been years since we last connected.
Yeah.
So a little bit about Space for Humanity is we are a nonprofit organization founded by Dylan Taylor, sort of as the philanthropic arm of his work. Our mission is to sponsor people from all over the world to go to space so that they can leave our planet and look back at it and have this experience that happens to astronauts called the overview effect. Have you guys talked about the overview effect on the show?
Yeah, we've had Frank on.
Okay, great. Then your listeners should know all about it. So yeah, when astronauts go to space and they see our planet from the outside, it causes a cognitive shift in awareness that makes them transform in a way. It gives them a greater awareness that they never, come back from, like they never go back to how their thinking was before. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes astronauts come back down with a completely new perspective about everything that is happening on our planet, from the environment to politics, to humanitarian issues, to even just their place in their local communities. And so we sponsor people from all over the world to go and have that experience so they can come back down and be like seeds planted far and wide to share this perspective as far and wide as they can in whatever way is true for them. And so far we've sent two people to space. We sent the first Mexican born woman to space. Her name's Katia Echezarreta. We sent her actually, we're celebrating the year anniversary of her flight this week. And then we sent the first African and Arab woman, as well as the first Egyptian person to space. Her name's Sarah Sabri. And we sent her in August of last year. And both of them have come back down and made astounding impacts, which I can talk about now or later.
Well, before you do, I'd like to just point out, you know, this is kind of a very comforting break from, I have nothing against billionaires, so my best friends are billionaires, but this is kind of a comforting break from who we usually see going on these trips. I mean, these are people from very different walks of life. Not necessarily from the United States and not necessarily from particularly affluent backgrounds. I mean, you're really going out and trying to pick folks from a wide distribution of backgrounds, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, there's a lot to say about that. One thing that I'll share is that we are the first nonprofit to ever sponsor someone to go to space. We're definitely the first nonprofit to ever sponsor two people to go to space. And we're sort of like a fellowship program where people can apply. So we've had at this point more than 10,000 people from more than 150 countries and nations apply to our program. Each round that we've had have had around 3,000 or so. We're currently in our next selection round right now. So we're literally whittling down a global group of 3,000 people to, you know, just a few, depending on what the selection is. And so that's why they're like these all-star people who are really set up to make an impact in the world, but also people who wouldn't otherwise have the opportunity. And I'm really proud to say that I believe as of today, there's been six women who have gone to space on Blue. I believe that there's been around 30 commercial astronauts on Blue. Rod, you might have a more current number, or Tarek. And it's like, when I see that image of the women, two of them are women that we've sponsored. And the team and I are incredibly proud to see that.
We should point out that when Rachel is saying Blue, she means Blue Origin. Obviously,
yes.
the new Shepard flights that are poised actually to begin anew in the next few months, which is pretty exciting. You know, Rachel, it's one thing to have a nonprofit with such great goals as Space for Humanity, to kind of expand the envelope of who gets to get to space and then share that experience with the world. But I know that you can tell us that it's a lot harder than collecting a bunch of nonprofit money and then booking a trip like on an airplane, like it would be. And I'm curious about that path in terms of like the timeline of the idea, the genesis of the idea, getting towards those first two flights. Can you kind of share like what that timeline was like, about how that kernel came together, how you were able to get the support that could get the space humanity off the ground, literally, than to get these first citizen astronauts into space.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So Dylan founded Space for Humanity out of a program that he was in at the Aspen Institute. It was called the Henry Crown Fellowship. So he was in a group of just, as he talks about it, just some of the most amazing leaders and human beings he had ever met. And the challenge of the program is to create a project or an organization or an impact program to address one of our greatest challenges. And so he had, as he tells it, he's in this group of people with some of the most brilliant minds in the world trying to address malnutrition, climate change, access to education, all of these challenges that seem intractable. And a lot of them were in a way feeling like, how can we possibly do this? And so as Dylan saw it, he was like, okay, we have all of these intractable challenges. And I believe in the Einstein quote, which is, we can't solve the problems we've created with the same level of thinking that created them. And ultimately, as he sees it, and as I see it, these challenges are all a matter of perspective. And in order to address the greatest challenges that we now face, we must see them from the actual context that they're occurring on, which is planetary. And so with him being a space guy, he sort of combined that, that like method of thinking with space, and that birthed Space for Humanity.
And yeah. To be clear, this is back in 2019, or did the origins start before that?
So the origin started before that. It was I believe 2013 is the year that he was in that program. And then in 2017 is when he announced Space for Humanity at the New Space Conference, which I'm sure a number of your listeners have been to. I happened to be in the audience in 2017, heard about the mission, was absolutely mind blown, like, holy, you know what, I need to get involved with this. I came on as a volunteer a few months later when it was a fully volunteer run team. And then in 2019 is when I came on as the executive director and the first full-time employee. Mm-hmm. And then since then has been the real work, I'll say. And for us, to go back to your question of like, how do we make this happen? Is it just, you know, getting money and, you know, buying a ticket and then that's that? I hope one day it's that easy. It's been a range of things, I'll say. It's kind of hard to even put into words exactly what all the things that it's been. But I mean, I think if anyone listening has built a company or is an entrepreneur or has built something from scratch, like, you don't just get, it's not typically so simple that you just have, you know, you get the money and you make it happen. It's like, you need to build a whole foundation in order to even get the money. And you need to, like, you know, build all like the whole network and even to make that possible. And, you need to build a whole program for people to want to invest in it. And then you need to build the whole team to build the program to, you know, make the network to do all this. It's like, there's a lot that goes into building a vision and, into having people want to be involved with a vision that hasn't necessarily come to fruition yet. And for us, when we were first founded, and even when I came on as executive director, no one was flying, you know, so we really were building a vision.
Yeah.
Building a vision that literally was not possible at the moment, but we knew that it would be soon. And so that's been the process, and it's been multiple years of doing that so that we would be even ready to receive funds to make it possible.
Yeah. And that first call for citizen astronauts back in, I guess it was 2019 about then, came out well before your first flight, before Blue Origin was even flying and Virgin Galactic were even flying, people to space, as well. So it seems like that paid off, but forgive me for one more question. But how do you even find a company how do you find a ride to space? Cause I can get, you know, go on Kayak and book a flight, but there's not a lot of companies that are flying, and you must have really good contacts as an organization to kind of like be able to track when those seats are available. And they fit up with the candidates that you have coming in.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, that's been a slow build. It's been a slow build since we first announced in 2017. You know, when I first came on the team, we had some relationships. I wouldn't say we had like the relationships, but I think if also anyone listening has built a business or a network or anything, it's like relationships oftentimes are a slow build. And so we built these slow relationships with all the spaceflight providers, you know, slowly gained credibility by doing the work that we needed to do until eventually they were ready to fly. And, you know, we were close, I'll say like close to top of the list in terms of when a seat opens up and they want to offer it to someone, close to the top of the list of who they call. And I feel really grateful for that, because that, and they've supported us and, you know, getting funds to help make the seats possible. But none of that would happen if we hadn't fully built a foundation and a program to make us ready for that. You know, if we just went out there and said we were doing it because we want to and we feel like it, it wouldn't serve the greater mission that we're all on, which is opening up access to space for everyone.
So let's talk about you for a second. I'm old enough to remember the Apollo era, and so we're watching that on the three, count them, three TV networks that existed. And Mission Control was filled with white guys with skinny, I mean, it's a joke nowadays, but it really was true. Skinny black ties, white shirts with short sleeves, which were hideous, pocket protectors, pen slide rules, the whole deal. And that was largely NASA in that era. That's changed, but it's still can be challenging from the young people I hear from, especially women, to break into this field. So you've done so. And I think there's a lot of people listening who would probably like to follow a similar trajectory. How did that happen for you? And what advice might you have?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. So I fell in love with space in like 2014, 2015. And for me, it was just like an instant obsession. I watched the first episode of Neil deGrasse Tyson's Cosmos, and it was like an awakening for me, and nothing was ever the same. And I became obsessed, and I knew I had to do everything I could to work in the space sector. And I guess I would ask anyone listening who wants to break in and not know how is like, what is your why? Is it to become interplanetary? Is it about the overview effect? Is it about investments? Is it about, you know, the what you believe is possible for life in the universe? Like, what is your why? And then find people with the same why. Because for me, before I even fully knew what my why was, I just still sort of obsessively went after it, went after what lit me up, I'll say. And that had me meet Frank White, Loretta Whiteside, Dylan Taylor, all people who later became my mentors and then my boss, you know, and then just people who sort of helped me get a space, like, you know, join the industry. And I will say that I spent multiple years being like, how the heck am I going to make this happen? Like, should I just let go of my space dreams? And then it did happen. And so I would just say, like, for people who, if you want it enough, just like you putting yourself out there and reaching out to the people who resonate with you and just like letting yourself get involved in all the ways that you can, like I am confident that you will break in. I think that's the main thing that I want to say. The other thing I'll acknowledge is that when I first joined the sector in around 2015, I don't have memories of there being many women, even just in 2015. And I think that most of the women were just much older. There weren't very many women that were my peers. It was different. And I would say since then, now almost 10 years later, there's like a whole influx of women and creatives and people with different sorts of backgrounds, because there's now programs specifically for them to be able to enter the industry. There's people who have like sort of dedicated their off time from working towards opening up access for them. You know, there's like fellowship programs and different ways to get involved. So I would invite anyone who's interested that like thinks there's not a fit for them in the industry to go and like find different programs and ways to get involved. And I'll just name a few, like for young professionals, there's the Space Generation Advisory Council, SGAC. There's the Brooke Owens Fellowship for women who are still in school. There's a number of different ways to get involved, and there's people who are really dedicating their time and energy to making that happen.
And you were the Rachel, a vice chair, right, for the students of the exploration of development. So for students, it's not too early for people to start getting thinking about how to get involved.
No, student. I was a student when I got first involved with space, and it's really awesome as a student. There's so much. Yeah, SEDS, Students for the Exploration and Development of Space. It's a great organization. Honestly, just go, if you're a student, just get involved with SEDS and, you know, try and run for office, run for the board, and you'll get right into the space industry.
I wanted to ask Rachel about the flights so far, because you've mentioned you've had a couple flights. It sounds like China, you know, the recruitment is a challenge because you get so many people apply, and then you have to make those decisions there. And can you walk us through, you know, each of those flights, or however you'd like to discuss about each of those candidates, what they experienced on those flights, how they've shared it to date, and what you're looking for the next one.
Yeah, absolutely. So through my however many years I've been doing this since 2017, through all those years of me, you know, working with Space for Humanity, I've had the honor and the pleasure of interviewing, at this point, I would say a few dozen astronauts. I've talked to them and heard about their experiences, and obviously talked to Frank and heard about the overview effect and just learned so much. And it's incredible to hear all the commonalities, but also all the differences between people's experiences. It's like everyone trying to describe the unknown in a way. It's like people trying to describe the unknowable in their own words and in their own experiences. And so, yeah, there's just a range, you know. There's people, and I will say, like, I talked to Ron Guerin, astronaut mm-hmm. Ron Guerin, who he wrote The Orbital Perspective, Floating in Darkness. He's amazing. His perspective, he blows my mind every time I talk to him. And he told me that even the astronauts who say it didn't impact them come back different. Like, he's like, it does change you. And so, you know, for me, watching Space for Humanity sponsor two people to go to space and have this experience has been like a dream being fulfilled. It's been like the most rewarding experience of my life. And so, yeah, we sent Katya to space, who talks beautifully about her experience and about how, looking out the window, there was like a single tear rolling down her face, just like experiencing the beauty of the Earth. And then and all she could think about when she was up there was the people that she loved. Like, how, you know, it's so big yet so small. And all she really cares about is the people that she loves. And so, yeah, for her, it sort of meant something around her love for people. Whereas Sarah Sabri, I actually had the honor of going to Crew Capsule Recovery. So when she came down, a small group of people were drive out with the Blue Origin, like Amazon cars. I can't remember what those are called. Do you guys know what I'm talking about?
Those electric trucks, right? That they've got.
Yeah. Like not. Yeah.
Rivian, Rivian.
Yeah. So we go out in the Rivians. And then, we get out, you know, there's like, people like ready to spray champagne and, you know, holding up their like country flags. And so we're all standing there waiting for them to get out of the capsule. We're like in the middle of the desert, you know, they can't like plan the exact spot that the capsule's going to land. So, you know, it could land amidst a bunch of cacti or something else. It was a pretty easy spot to walk in, which was good. But anyway, so we're all waiting out there. The door opens and we wait a few minutes and no one's coming out. And then slowly Sarah emerges. She's the first one to come out. And right when she comes out, she throws her hands up at the sky, like looks up, and she's just crying. Aww. Because she was so moved by the experience. And she came back over and she said, first of all, she's like speechless. You know, it's like no words can describe the ineffable in a way. And she's like, she says that the view just enters you. So like this view of space, it's not something that you can think or like even fully get. It's this view just enters you. And I think that perfectly describes also like the paradigm shift that happens when people have these sorts of experiences.
Yeah.
Paradigm shifts aren't something that you can think your way through. There's something, it's like a moment that expands your view of reality forever. And I think that perfectly encapsulates what that is.
And we should remind folks that both Sarah and Katja were able to look at the Earth from some of the largest windows ever built for space that are on New Shepard. And if you're wondering, by the way, Katya's flight was the NS-21 Blue Origin flight launched in June 4th, actually just past a year. You just mentioned that in 2022. And then Sarah's flight NS-22 was in August 4th. So it was a big summer for space for humanity in 2022 last year.
Yeah, it was really exciting. We're still all pinching ourselves that it happened, and we learned so much along the way as well. In building out our program, so we treat it like a transformational experience, which it is, obviously. But in any sort of transformational experience, you need to be prepped for it. Like, get yourself ready to experience it, get your mind ready, get past your fears so that you can really take it all in. And then you go and you have the transformational experience, you come back. And then we support our citizen astronauts in integrating it and really making sense of it and letting it change them. Because if it's just a joyride and they're like, that was cool, like, I'm going to go back to my day job, what's the point? You know, right. It's really about them using this perspective now and letting it change them, letting themselves be different for it. And then going in, as mentioned, like, making an impact around it. And I'll share about that now, actually. It's been astounding to watch the impact that these two human beings have made since. Katya, the list of her achievements, I can't even track anymore at this point, but she's like, she was on the cover of Glamour Mexico, on the cover of Vogue. She's about to be on the cover of another fashion magazine that I don't know which magazine it is, but she's going to be on the cover of another one. So she's like going into fashion as an engineer, as someone who's flown to space. Has that happened before ever? I don't know that it has.
I don't think glamour, no.
No, she was a Glamour Woman of the Year in Mexico for STEM.
Wow.
She got the keys to the city of Guadalajara, which is where she's from. She's met with the Mexican president. She's working on passing a bill with Congress. She's creating a foundation to help children and young people and researchers in Mexico get funding and become more involved with space and learn about space. Yeah, she's making an amazing, amazing impact and basically just like working on helping build the Mexican space program and have Mexico be a player in space, which is amazing.
Well, I have to just note that I once had the keys to the city of Los Angeles, but it was only because I had a job with them. So it wasn't with any fanfare. I will be back with my next burning question as soon as we take this short break to hear from one of our sponsors. Stay with us. So your goal, if I understand correctly, is to send 10,000 people from all walks of life into space over the next decade. Is that correct?
That was our founding goal, which at the time, I will say in 2017, we thought that there would be flight providers flying by the end of the year in right. 2017. There was, I wouldn't call it, it wasn't misinformation. It was just people didn't know.
Yeah.
So at the time, that was our founding goal. Now we do want, our goal is to send 10,000 people to space. And the time, I wouldn't say that there's like a set timeline for that, but it's like, we want to get to enough of a tipping point that there's more, you know, these people are seeding, sharing far and wide. And then there's more and more people who just see that we live on a planet, on this interconnected, beautiful, fragile planet. And systems change once you reach a tipping point of a certain number of people having a perspective, that's when actually greater societal shifts begin to happen. So that is why we have that goal.
So far you've flown with New Shepard, with Blue Origin, but I think you've got a partnership with, is it Stratolaunch, the balloon company?
So we have a partnership. So we've launched with Blue Origin,
right.
Sent two people to space with Blue Origin. We have a partnership with Virgin Galactic. We did a sweepstakes with them actually in 2021. when they first launched a space where we were the beneficiary of a campaign where they randomly selected someone to go to space who should be flying at some point soon. And then we also, we have a partnership with Worldview. Stratospheric Balloon Company. So we have their first full mission to space, which is exciting. Looking at, they're saying 2024, 2025. And then we have flight number 26 with Space Perspective, which is also a stratospheric balloon company. The reason flight number 26 is because flight number 1 through 25 were for like investors. And so we were basically the very first one after that. And then in talks with Virgin Galactic about something in the future. Of course, we've talked a bit to Axiom. At this moment, we're not looking at orbital flights. We're just looking at stratospheric and suborbital. And we love Axiom. We've got a number of their leadership members on our advisory board.
So the obvious question, of course, is when do you go and when does Frank White go? Well, of course, when do I get to go? But that, you know. That's a very low.
We could just like all plan a flight together at some point.
I'm for that. Yeah, that sounds great.
You don't get to come because you're going to fall out of your crew chair and hurt yourself.
But it's okay because it's space. We'll float around.
Yeah.
That's right.
So, okay. Let's let her answer the question.
Yeah.
I'm not doing this for me to go to space, I would say.
Well, I know, but you must.
I don't know. I will say when I first discovered my love for space, for me, I was like, I want to be an astronaut. That's the dream. And since then, it's just become more about the paradigm shift, like the transformation that I believe every human being on this planet needs. And I don't really need to go to space personally to create that paradigm shift. Of course, if someone wanted to give me a ticket, I would accept, but I'm not trying to make that happen for me. And then for Frank, I think I know a lot of people who really want him to go to space. So, and I know that he's like dedicated his whole life to, first of all, this perspective, but then also to him hopefully going to space. So I hope that he goes too. And if there's anything that I can do to help, I am here for it.
Well, I think I've related this story before, but, I of course also grew up wanting to be an astronaut, and there was absolutely nothing else. I mean, back in that time, all my friends were, oh, I want to be a football player. I want to be a baseball player. I want to be a dog catcher, whatever it is I thought they wanted to do or could do. I wanted to be an astronaut. And then in my late 20s, I think it was, I got to sit in a Gemini capsule trainer. And if you've seen a Gemini capsule, you know that it's basically 1.5 Mercury capsules with two guys in it sitting shoulder to shoulder for up to 2 weeks. I sat in it for about 10 minutes and they closed the hatch. And there was that little voice in my head that suddenly started screaming, let me out of here. That was the end of my astronaut designs because claustrophobia is not a good trait. Anyway.
Were you in there alone or with someone else?
No, I was in there alone with a comparative acreage next to me. And I was still getting those cold sweats that you get if the elevator takes too long to open. And I see Ant's got a picture up now of a Gemini crew inside the capsule. And it's funny, if you saw First Man, of course, they documented the Gemini flights, but from the angles they shot, they made the capsule look like my living room. And when you realize that these astronauts were mostly fairly short, with the hatch closed, it was touching their heads, they were shoulder to shoulder. And like I said, up to 2 weeks in that thing without opening the hatches once. Yeah, I mean, that's superhuman. But I digress. Tarek, what's next for you?
You know, I was curious about how Dylan Taylor's flight informed the program for citizens, because of course he had a chance to fly on Blue Origin. You've had two other citizens fly there, and I'm curious how Space for Humanity goes to you know prepare your citizen astronauts for that flight, and to think about not to just go have the experience and then process it, but to be thinking about how they're going to experience it, what they're looking to share, you know, if they've got plans, you know, to try to take in certain aspects of the flight and then to share that later on. Does it help that Dylan has had that experience firsthand, and has he given tips to these citizen astronauts before they fly?
Yeah, I'll it all helps. Everything helps. All the data helps. All the as many people going to space as possible helps. It all really helps. And having them involved with the program helps as well. Dylan going to space was really solidifying for our program. Actually, if anyone wants to go to his blog, I believe it's dylantaylor.org. He has a whole series called Journey to the Dream. It's like a 5-part series. You've got to scroll back a bit to find it, but it's like his personal accounts of getting ready for it and then going to space and then coming back. And he says it was one of the most transformational moments of his life. And the only thing that was like this transformational was seeing the birth of his two daughters, which is a pretty profound experience watching a human being come out of another. And he says, like, if anybody questions if someone can experience the overview effect on a suborbital flight, I'm here to tell you that you absolutely can. And he says, I remember I actually interviewed him a few days after his flight, and he was just talking about how it sort of shifts your priorities and it like has you really think about what matters. I mean, sort of related to Katya being like, feeling your love for her family. And I don't know if anyone listening has had an experience in their life, maybe someone passing away or, just like a big shift or like a big change in your life, a big experience that has had you just reframe your priorities. And that's what these sorts of experiences can do as well, which is really important. Honestly, like everyone needs to get clear on what their priorities are and like stop being driven by things that don't really serve them. So I would say that in that way, it was really great. Another thing is we did some research with a researcher out of Johns Hopkins. He's like our main research advisor. His name's David Yaden, and he did a little bit of psychological research, both on Dylan and with our citizen astronauts, seeing the impact psychologically that this experience had on them. And there were measurable impacts around like typical characteristics, like experiencing awe is this really big part of the overview effect and typically carries on afterwards. Experiencing our interconnectedness, feeling like a little bit less of a feeling of self-importance because you see that you're part of something bigger. These are all things that can be measured psychologically and that these studies, which we haven't released, showed after the flight, it did happen. So that's all been really helpful. And then the last thing I'll say is that when people have these sorts of transformational experiences, a lot of times it can feel really isolating. So if not given support, I know astronauts who have struggled with alcoholism and depression. And I know that there's at least one astronaut that's committed suicide since returning. And this was like 10 plus years ago. But it can be really isolating to have an experience that fundamentally changes your view of reality and then be like, who gets this? Who do I talk to that can actually understand this? And so for us, a really big part of our program is also building a community between the citizen astronauts and other former astronauts, other commercial astronauts, just helping them all come together and share their experience together as like a support system. That's something that has proven really important to the experience as well.
It's so interesting you mention these sometimes adverse effects, because we talked a while ago on the show about Buzz Aldrin when he came back. Neil and Mike Collins went out. I mean, they all went out and did their tour, and then for a month, I think, around the world. And then Neil went off eventually to teach at Ohio State, and Mike Collins went off to run the Smithsonian. And Buzz really sunk into serious depression and alcoholism, which wasn't particularly remarkable because a few others did. But what was remarkable is he wrote a book about it, which if you're a test pilot and an astronaut and an American hero back in those days, you didn't do that. And I think it really pulled back the covers and said, look, this is a thing. It's not everybody's problem, but it is a problem. And I was reminded of that when I saw Shatner getting off of the New Shepard and, everybody's running around and cheering and shaking up the champagne bottles and they're trying to get a few words with him. And he just kind of looked at everybody and said, just give me a minute, because he was experiencing something profoundly different. And I think his experience from what I've read of it was different than most of the people that have flown. It was a very mixed bag of awe and wonder, but also sadness and almost a grief. Wasn't clear exactly on what the core of that was, but maybe part of it was just this force shift in his perspective about the home planet. And beyond that, he just kept talking about blackness and, you know, the kind death. Of desolation.
And death. Yeah, he said it was like death.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah, he said death, mm-hmm. Which didn't sound particularly positive, but it's still profound and important, important part of the conversation.
And I can speak to that as well. So we were actually, selected as the nonprofit beneficiary of the William Shatner film, which is really exciting. So there's a documentary, hasn't been released yet, but we got to go to a screening of it at South by Southwest, just like us and a few of our donors and supporters. I'm not Shatner, so I can't like speak to exactly what he experienced, but I can speak to what I've learned from watching the art that he's created since. Mm. He's created profound works of art. He created an incredible music piece with an orchestra, I think out of Orlando, that is going to be published at some point. Basically talking about that grief, Rod, like it was grief from my understanding of it. And I think that there's like a depth that I can't touch in recounting it. But it was grief for like the beauty and the miraculousness of the planet and the lack of awareness that we have in the way that we are treating it but more than treating it, it's like the systems that we've created that are like decimating it in a way. Mm-hmm. And so he has created art to express these feelings that have left me, myself, and a number of other people that have watched it in tears, because it is incredible. And I think that also goes back to, there's a quote from an Apollo astronaut went there. I can't remember which one.
The infamous Ed Mitchell quote, the salty one?
No, the we should have sent poets.
Oh,
we should have sent
Mike
a poet.
Collins, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't, or like Eugene Cernan, maybe. I'm not sure, but Gene, we should have sent a poet. And I think that Shatner is the perfect example of this, of like, he is an artist in a way. He's like, he has trained his whole life to be able to experience like a deep human experience, deep emotions. And he's trained to be able to express those as well. And so he went and he took that grief, and he took that sadness, and he took that like profundity that he felt, and he created art from it, an art that like won't leave the listeners or the viewers the same. And then I will also say, I think that with him, he's now 93, I believe, possibly 92. And so I think it's natural that like he's probably thinking about death a lot. Mm-hmm. And so he went and he saw that blackness and he was like, that is like death. And this earth, this is like life. And so a lot of his documentary also is sort of like his reflections on death. I think that it's just been something that he's been thinking about for a while now, which right. I would imagine I'll do that once I'm in my 90s as well.
Oh, you don't
I already do it, honestly.
I was going to say, you don't have to wait to your 90s. I think every week.
Well, you know, we've been talking, Rachel, a lot about the citizen astronaut kind of effort at Space for Humanity, but there's other programs that the organization does. You have the Overview Leadership Program. And I did want to make sure that we had some time to ask about that, where you're building a network of leaders in the space, you know, to kind of keep that vision going forward. And I was just curious if you can give us like an idea of what that project is like, how it works together with the astronaut program, to get the message out, maybe to a wider audience there.
Absolutely. Yeah. So yeah, our leadership program, basically it's a citizen astronaut training program, which I mentioned, but I think the thing that I want to underline, which I touched on earlier, is I've done a lot. The team has, you know, the people who have built this done a lot of research about how we can create greater changes in our systems. Cause ultimately it's not just about one person. It's about like, it is about the systems that we've created and the dysfunction of them and how they perpetuate people not being healthy, people not even knowing how to be healthy, really, mm-hmm. you know, and also they perpetuate really dysfunctional relationship with our planet and like not like a relationship that can't last for the long term. Yeah. So our Overview Leadership Program is really, it is actually the Citizen Astronaut Program that we've created, but it's with the, like our theory of change is that is in order to create shifts in our systems, changes in our systems, we all need to transcend the perspectives that we currently have. And there's actually research from different systems change theorists that say that the most powerful way to create changes in our systems is to create a collective paradigm shift. To have as many people as possible in this world expand their perspectives and see the world from a bigger place. And so we believe that by giving as many people access to this perspective, they'll be more powerful leaders. They'll make decisions on behalf of each other, of themselves, and of the planet. And in turn, the systems that we now exist in will evolve and change and into things that are more favorable for all of us as well as for the world. So our Overview Leadership Program is designed to help leaders in the world, which anyone can also do this, I would say. Like, and not anyone can take the program, but anyone can work to expand their perspective. Our Overview Leadership Program specifically is to help people expand their perspectives so that we can create that shift in the world.
So I think we have a few more questions, but I wanted to ask about risk, because part of this conversation, of course, has to address risk. And you're not the flight carrier, you know, you're not the provider, but people, so if I sign a waiver, it'd probably be with Blue Origin or with Virgin Galactic or whomever. But there is an element of risk in this. It's still something fairly new. It's not commercial airliner flights yet. So I'm sure you had internal conversations about this, and I don't expect you to share those, obviously, but you know, how do you address the concept of the significant risk that people are taking on as they go even to suborbital space?
Yeah, it's definitely a really important topic. And we've talked to lawyers and we've talked to the flight providers and of course we make it really clear to the people applying to our program as well as to the people who are selected for our program that is a choice that they're making. I will say that, you know, after speaking with people who have gone to space with the flight providers, after speaking to the flight providers myself, I know that these systems are tested and tested and tested over and over and over and over again in all the ways to just make sure that it is as close to, you know, the top of safety, like as close to 100% as they possibly can. And I think risk is a really important topic, and it's really important to just, you know, consent with the people that are flying that they know that, like, this is what they're doing.
Right.
If, Rachel, if folks are looking to learn more about how to apply to any of Space for Humanity's programs, let alone the Citizen Astronaut Project, I mean, is there a specific place at the organization to go to? Is it as easy as filling out a form online, or do they have to do what sort of prerequisites do they need to keep in mind if they're going to try to apply to one of your programs there? And where do they go to do it?
Yeah. So if you want to apply to go to space with Space for Humanity, you can go to spaceforhumanity.org/apply. Applications are currently closed at this moment, but they will be opened fairly soon. So just keep checking, get on our email list and you'll get that notification. Follow us on Instagram at Space Humanity. And then I'll just say what we're looking for. We use the letters LCDI, which stands for Leadership, Community Development, and Impact. So we don't care who you are. We don't care where you are. We do care what you're doing as long as it's mission aligned, but we don't actually care what that is. So we're looking for people who are leaders or have demonstrated leadership, people who are working on community development. So they care about their community and they care about making a difference in their community. And then people who have demonstrated impact as well. And so then we support whoever we select and really honing in on all of that. And then using their spaceflight experience to expand on it in bigger and bigger ways.
And I assume there's ways to get involved other than applying to be a citizen astronaut, correct?
Yeah. You can apply as a volunteer on our website. If you go to, I think it's the contribute button. And then also just follow us on Instagram, follow us on social media, follow us across platforms, as I said, at Space Humanity, and we'll be putting in other opportunities to get involved as well.
And if I recall correctly, I was looking at it just this morning. I think you have a job listing open.
Do we?
I think it's development or fundraising or something, which
that is, that is correct.
I looked
at
it and thought, oh, that is not my strength, but it'll be somebody,
so. It's a little bit dated, but we are still looking for that position. So definitely apply. If anyone has experience in development for nonprofit, loves the mission, wants to get involved, wants an epic network of space investors and CEOs and donors, we would love to hear from you.
Well, did we miss anything important that you want to talk about, either about this or about yourself?
I don't think so. I think we're good. Yeah. I'll just say the last thing is, like, for me, it's really all about transformation. Mm. And there's so many ways that we can create that transformation. And spaceflight is an incredible tool to create profound transformation.
Well, that's a profound statement. And on that, I want to thank everybody for joining us for our chat with Rachel Lyons, the Executive Director of Space for Humanity, and your best chance, unless you're particularly wealthy, for a ride into the wild black yonder. Rachel, where can we track your activities? You already gave us the website, but one more time, please.
Yeah, spaceforhumanity.org, at spacehumanity, and also at space_Rach.
Space Rach, I like that. And of course, you can always find me at the boring and unchanging pilebooks.com and at adastromagazine.com, which is our magazine website for the National Space Society. And we are upgrading that this month. So we'll see some changes there and a lot more free stuff you can get. Tarek, you.
Yes. Well, I am at space.com as always. And of course, on the Twitter at Tarek J. Malik, and perhaps at this next Blue Origin flight, as they resume flight in the next few weeks. That was some news that came out in the last couple of weeks, and it's good to see those flights getting started again after their uncrewed flight last year.
And you're going?
Well, no, I'd hope to go. I'm just saying that it's coming up, and perhaps I'll get a chance to go out and go watch that thing get off the ground.
Travel budgets. Well, and of course, don't forget to drop us a line at twis@twit.tv. That's TWIS at twit.tv. Welcome your comments, suggestions, and ideas, as always. And we do answer each and every message we get, whether they're nice or not. But so far, they all have been. So thank you to you out there who are listening. And don't forget to check out space.com. The website's in the name. And the National Space Society at NSS.org. Both are great places to satisfy your spaceflight cravings. New episodes of this podcast publish every Friday on your favorite podcatcher. So make sure to subscribe, tell your friends, and give us reviews. We'll take 5 stars or a thumbs up or a rubber chicken or whatever you got. You can also head to our website at twit.tv/TWIS. Finally, please don't forget you can get all the great programming on the Twit Network ad-free on Club Twit, as well as some extras that are only available there, like, do I need to say it again, Tarek falling off his chair, for just $7 a month. That it was worth it. For me,
one time. One time.
Just to see you take the dive. Finally, you can follow the Twit Tech Podcast Network at Twit on Twitter and on Facebook and twit.tv on Instagram. Thank you very much, and we will see you next week.
Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here. In case you hadn't heard, Home Theater Geeks is back. Each week, I bring you the latest audio-video news, tips and tricks to get the most out of your AV system, product reviews, and more. You can enjoy Home Theater Geeks only if you're a member of Club Twit, which costs $7 a month. Or you can subscribe to Home Theater Geeks by itself for only $2.99 a month. I hope you'll join me for a weekly dose of Home Theater Geekitude.